Oh my God, we're back. The internet outage that plagued us for about 45 minutes, maybe almost an hour, is done. And we're back for now, so fingers crossed. Thank you for your patience. By the way, I'm getting tons of texts at 7:10:10 telling me that this was a much bigger internet outage than I thought. Whole areas of the nation's capital, but other parts of the province of Ontario as well. I don't know how widespread it was, but you can certainly text us if you can, if your outage is there, is not happening at 7:10:10. Just let me know. I'm very intrigued. But boy, it goes down and all of a sudden, you know, you're done. Almost 4 years after his brother was killed. People say he died, but he was killed. He was killed after an, quote, altercation with guards in 2016. His name? Suleiman Fakhiri. Suleiman Fakhiri was in the Central East Correctional Center in London, sorry, in Lindsay, Ontario. He was in there for 11 days. He was 30 years old. It was December 2016. After 11 days, he was dead. His body came down. There were 50 signs of blunt impact trauma. He was beaten. This was the altercation with the guard. There's video of it. I've been talking to his brother, Yusuf Fakhiri, about trying to find justice for years. I've done multiple stories. We've all expected that someone would finally be charged. There is a new development today that is going to stun you, and I want Yusuf Fakhiri to talk about it. Yusuf, first of all, my friend, always an honor to have you on the show. Here we are almost 4 years after you've sought justice for your brother, Solly. What is the latest news?
And thank you for having me here, and thank you for letting me continue to share Suleiman's story. A stunningly disappointing gross injustice and the miscarriage of justice news is that the OPP did not have the courage to lay criminal charges against the guards who killed Suleiman Fakhiri, Evan.
They're not going to be charges. Nobody's going to be accountable for the death of your brother.
No, sir.
Why? What did the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police, say?
So let's put the facts here, Evan. They admit that there was 50 bruises on Suleiman's body. They admit that the law guards put his legs and his hands tied. They pepper sprayed him. They know which guard gave which punch, which guard put his knee on Suleiman's neck. They say that Mr. Thibault, the eyewitness, was credible. But the rationale that the OPP says in terms of the decision is that we cannot lay charges because we do not know which guard gave the fatal blow, Evan. What this is effectively saying is that if you want to commit murder, Evan, do it in a group.
If you want to commit murder, do it in a group. I just don't understand this. There's video. There's witnesses. And this has been going on for 4 years. And now they're saying, well, we just can't determine. So we're going to let everybody off the hook.
Exactly, Evan. Because they know which guard did what, but they don't know who gave the fatal blows. So if this is new law, Evan, then that means that they're sending this new message to everybody across our nation that if you want to, like, commit, you know, say, a murder, do it in a group, Evan. They didn't even press assault charges, let alone homicide, sir.
So nobody. Your brother was in custody for 11 days.
Yes, sir.
Your brother was in segregation. Your brother was known to have a mental illness. He has this altercation. We've seen the video. And you're saying that 50 bruises on his body, the punching, when they drag him out of the hallway into his cell where the cameras aren't and guards flood in and he's dead, not one of those guards has anything, no charges against anybody, not even an assault charge?
Not at all, Evan. And there's another important fact to this case. The Crown attorney gave the advice to the OPP that there should be no charges because this is not a winnable case. The Crown attorney, Evan, also, their legal opinion was that there should be no charges. So the OPP told my family that this is an independent investigation, Evan. So why was the local Crown doing this, Evan, not individuals that were not in the... It was the same Lindsay Crown, Evan, that gave the advice to the OPP. The same Lindsay Crown that gave the advice to Coastal Lakes Police not to press charges is the same Lindsay Crown.
This is outrageous. I just want people to understand, I'm going to let you describe it because it's, I want people to understand the level of beating here. Folks, this did not, whatever you think, I'm going to let Yusuf describe when they got the report back, and I've read it, but when they got the body back of Suleiman Fakhiri. Suleiman Fakhiri, his 30-year-old brother, Yusuf's brother. Just listen to how Yusuf, and Yusuf, please, I know this is difficult. Believe me, I know. You and I have spoken many, many times. But I want people to realize what these guards did to this man. They beat him brutally. And no, there's going to be no charges, zero charges, nothing. What happened to your brother?
Evan, not only did he have his legs and his hands tied, one of the guards had his knee on Suleiman's neck. There was 50 bruises throughout his body. So there's a huge gash on his forehead. There was abrasions. There was contusions. His whole body, when we got his body, I couldn't even look at it, Evan. It was all filled in like bruises. You couldn't count. You when you saw his wrists, Evan, you could see the pain that it caused when he was handcuffed and when he was in shackles. Go ahead, sir.
No, you continue, Yusuf.
The violent way that they killed him, Evan. No one deserves to lose their life the way he did. Especially, you know, Evan, he was suffering. He was suffering from schizophrenia, sir. He shouldn't have even been there to begin with. He was on his way to a hospital.
I want people to realize when he was beaten to death, and that's what his lawyers allege happened, that he was beaten to death. Okay? He was in restraints. People might say, well, as I understand it, he was resisting. He was in the shower and he was resisting. Yes, he's a mentally ill man. But at the time that he was dragged, he was handcuffed. He was in foot shackles, handcuffs, and he had a spit hood over his head, right?
Yes, Evan. Yes,
he was. So his ability to harm the guards, he has a hood over his head. He's shackled, his arms and legs are shackled. And how many guards poured into that cell? And when they poured into the cell off camera, then Suleiman mysteriously dies.
Yes, sir.
How can it take so many people to restrain a guy who's already restrained?
Exactly, Evan. You know, you mentioned at the beginning of the show altercation. You know, that the police had altercation. What altercation, Evan, when your legs and your hands are tied, sir? Like, what altercation, Evan? He was tied. And then, Evan, after they did this to him, they put a spit hood and then they pepper sprayed him and then put him down on his stomach.
So now I got a minute here, Yusuf. I'm going to continue following this. This development today that nobody will be charged, are you going to ask the province to investigate?
Evan, the province, Doug Ford owes it to every single Canadian, not just to Suleiman and the Fakhiri family, to step in and do Canadians right. And let me be clear, Evan Solomon, and I appreciate everything you've done for our family, for giving us a platform. This fight is far from over, Evan, because this isn't just about Suleiman anymore, sir. This is about every Canadian who's lost their lives at the hands of the justice system, who suffered from mental illness. We are not deterred by the OPP's failure in doing their job. We will continue to fight, Evan. This is far from over, sir.
We will continue to listen to you and try to find justice for you, Yusuf Fakhiri. We'll take a short break. An incredible story coming up. Stay with us.
As this story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. 75 years ago, the United States, the aircraft, the Enola Gay, dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima. And then Nagasaki, of course. It is long said, long been repeated, that that's how the war ended. That the display of the horrific power of the nuclear bombs dropped that killed anywhere between 135,000 and maybe 300,000 civilians ended the war and saved lives. And it was a brutal decision for President Truman, and we got to have a moment of silence that nuclear bombs being dropped is a terrible thing. As Robert Oppenheimer, the mastermind behind the development of nuclear weapons, when he saw it first tested, he said, I am death, destroyer of worlds. The awesome, terrifying power. But it's long been justified as a way to ends justified the means, and the means were brutal, but it maybe saved lives. But 75 years later, many people say, no, no, no. Japan would have surrendered anyway. Japan was on its last legs. Even the military commanders, famous commanders like Joe Nimitz, now we named aircraft carriers after them in the United States, the Nimitz class carriers, they said, we didn't need to drop the bombs at all. The Russians had already started attacking and days before defeated the Japanese. The Russians' engagement against the Japanese really ended it. Or the fact that Japan had no more control over their airspace. Matt Gurney is a columnist and editor at the National Post. Matt's grandfather fought throughout the war heroically as a pilot in the RAF. And he was on Twitter today, and it was a fascinating exchange, saying that his grandfather's note said he was happy that bomb was dropped because it saved lives, maybe his life. Matt's on the line with me now. Matt, I hope you and the family are doing well.
Yeah, we're doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me, just before we get to this, this is a horrible anniversary, 75 years. Just tell us a bit about your grandfather and his time in the war. Where did he serve?
You know what? I never knew him. He passed away before my time. So everything I know about him, I know from having spoken with my dad and my grandmother and reading his letters and his journals and his flight log. But yeah, you've got the crux of it. He was a Canadian boy from Toronto, joined the Royal Canadian Air Force, was a wireless air gunner in bombers, served first in Europe on U-boat patrols, and eventually was transferred to a Royal Air Force squadron, as you said, that was stationed in India. And, you know, reading his letters, some of which survived, he sent back to his family here, and then reading his journal, there isn't an entry from the day of itself, but there's an entry from a couple of days later where he's talking about, well, the Americans have some new wonder bomb, and no one really knew much about it, but because of this, it looks like Japan is done, and we're going to get to go home. And, you know, it's funny, my grandfather was not in a combat unit at the time. When he was stationed in India, he was in an air transport unit, and he almost was killed. He was the sole survivor of a plane that crashed while on a apparently routine flying mission. So it always struck me as interesting as even a guy a couple thousand kilometers away from the fighting, even a guy who was not at that time in a combat unit, every day his life was in danger because flying around these big war machines, even if you're not getting shot at, is inherently dangerous.
But Matt, it was interesting the response, because we have all long repeated that the terrible decision to drop bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I should say, we're basically the people that died there were seniors, women and children, because most fighting age men were at war.
Mm-hmm.
So now we'd already had remember, as bad as they were, the firebombing of Tokyo probably killed more people, like the firebombing in Dresden. I mean, this happens. This is a big deal. But when you posted this story about your grandfather, there was a lot of kickback saying, wait a second, there was no need to drop this nuclear bomb. And in fact, The Nation, the magazine, had a series of articles, and many of them, many historians, where they quote many of the leaders of the Allied forces saying we didn't need to bomb Japan at all. This was basically a bunch of scientists wanting to test out their new, quote, toy. What do you make of that?
You know, I think there's probably some truth to that. If you read about President Truman's decision making ahead of dropping the bomb, it is absolutely true that there was a sense that we've spent $2 billion in 1945 money developing this thing. We're going to look like idiots if we don't end up using it. The decision to drop the bomb was, even among the president's close advisors, controversial. There were a lot of differences in opinions. Some people thought the bomb should not have been dropped. Some people thought the bomb should be dropped, but on a purely military target, a Japanese fleet at anchor or a naval base. Others thought maybe it should be a neutral third country should arrange a demonstration on an island or something somewhere. So there were a lot of these debates happening. And the Nation piece that you referenced is interesting. It quotes a number of U.S. generals as saying the bomb was not a military necessity. I actually don't disagree with that. The bomb was not a military necessity. What the bomb did was took an inevitability and made it happen faster. Japan was defeated. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But it is arguable that the use of the nuclear weapons, combined with the Soviet Union joining the war, gave within the Japanese government, there were those who wanted to come to peace, and there were those who were resisting that violently, as it turned out. And the bombs plus the Russian attack actually gave the advantage internally to those in the Japanese government who were saying it was time to throw in the towel. And what's fascinating is a lot of people don't forget this. After the Russians had attacked, after Hiroshima had been destroyed, and then eventually after Nagasaki was destroyed as well, when the Japanese emperor decided to surrender, to make that announcement, there was an attempted coup by members of the military command to try and take him into custody and prevent that announcement from being made. Even after the Russian attack and even after two nuclear strikes on their country, there was a sizable faction of the Japanese government that intended to stay in the fight longer.
Right. And you know, this is revisionist history. You don't know if more lives, what an invasion of Japan would have taken and cost in terms of blood and treasure. We should say that even as Japan was losing the war and the battles on Iwo Jima, on Wake Island, the Japanese were ferociously fighting even when they had long lost the war. So the idea that Allied troops would just be able to march into Japan in a number of days is also bogus, because the Japanese had been fighting furiously on lost causes for months, if not years, but really quickly in the nation. Admiral William Leahy, the chief of staff, wrote in his memoir, the use of this barbarous weapon on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. The Japanese were, quote, defeated and ready to surrender. The commander of the Air Force said also, we didn't need to do it. Japan was hopeless. We didn't need to do it. Even, as I say, Chester Nimitz, the commander of the Pacific Fleet, said we didn't need to do it. So I don't know how I know we got a minute here, Matt, but this is an argument without end. The use of nuclear weapons is a terrifying thing. And yet, here we are debating whether it was still justifiable in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
We'll debate it forever, but I would close by saying this. People seem to think the option was between nuke the Japanese or immediately have peace with the Japanese. But there's two problems with this. First of all, for all the reasons you have said, Japan was defeated. They no longer had the ability to meaningfully resist, and yet they were still refusing to surrender. So I've kind of the main argument against, oh, but Japan was about to surrender, is that what was holding them back? Why didn't they? The other thing to remember, and you've already alluded to this, when the atom bombs were dropped, the American Air Force, using conventional firebombs, was already mowing their way through every large Japanese city. They had run out of Japanese large cities. They were going after the medium-sized ones, combined with the fact that the U.S. Navy blockade had already pushed Japan to the brink of starvation. So it's not this option between Japan gets bombed twice or it's peace and plenty. It's they either get bombed twice or the firebombing continues. The blockade continues. The Russian invasion continues. There were not a lot
Matt,
of good options.
I'm going to have to do that. Matt Gurney from the National Post, great thread. And by the way, there were concerns that Russia, if they entered the war, would take some Japan. We'll be right back.
Talking to the newsmakers every day. The conversation continues with Evan Solomon.
There's a story that's just broken by Bob Fife and Steve Chase of the Globe, and Bob's going to jump on our line in a minute. Saudi Arabia allegedly, this is incredible. This is an incredible story. Apparently, Saudi Arabia was about to send a hit squad to Canada to take out some critics of the regime. Saudi Crown Prince sent hit squad to Canada, exiled spy chief says. Wow. According to the Globe, and Bob's going to join us, I'm going to read the top. This just broke. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince dispatched a hit squad to Toronto in an attempt to murder a former high-ranking intelligence officer, and then an effort made shortly after the assassination of the dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. Holy mackinac. This is the regime that, by the way, remember, it was John Baird who said we should apologize. Jeez. Kissing butt to the Saudi regime is just not on. I'm going to bring on, and I want to talk about that, but China's got it. There's another person charged with put on the death sentence in China, another Canadian. So I'm going to bring on Dick Fadden, the former National Security Advisor, both to Prime Ministers Harper and Trudeau, and the former director of Canada's spy agency, CSIS. Dick, first of all, I hope you and the family are well, and great to have you here. Man, the news is coming up fast. Maybe before we hit China, just because you're the former head of national security and CSIS, that Globe story which just broke is pretty stunning, that they sent a hit squad.
Well, no, I agree. I know the Saudi intelligence officer who's at issue here, and if he says this has happened, I'm inclined to believe him. Bob tends not to report things that aren't true. So I think your comment of a minute or two ago needs to be repeated. This is a really very unsavory regime, and we would do well to think carefully through what we're going to have to do with them. The good news is they didn't get through. The bad news is they could well try again.
What is it? I mean, we're selling light armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia. They're sending hit squads to Canada to assassinate people.
Yeah, I don't know really what to say to that. Of course, the sale to Saudi Arabia was organized well before this happened and well before the current crown prince was in his current position. So, I mean, you know, there's a temporal issue here. But I must say, at one point, I thought we should honor our contract with Saudi Arabia and maintain, you know, our sales because we did have a contract. And the Foreign Affairs has frequently reviewed whether or not they're being used in against civil populations, and the conclusion was no, they were not. Having said this, you know, it seems that every week or every couple of weeks there's some more bad news or negative news about Saudi Arabia, and I begin to wonder whether we should have a heck of a lot to do with them.
It's impossible to trust the leaders of Saudi Arabia now. Come on, they openly murdered Jamal Khashoggi. They've even now admitted it, not who gave the order, which may well be the crown prince. But if they're ready, how can you trust a regime that's sending assassination squads to Canada after they've already murdered in Turkey? They sent with a bone saw Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah, I don't know how you can do that. But, you know, we have to remember the Russians did the same thing against one of their citizens in the United Kingdom. So this is not unique. And somewhere we have to find a way of coping with the fact that these countries, you know, are in this planet, on this planet, in this world, but at the same time not getting anywhere near cozy with them. So I would argue, you know, if these facts are substantiated by the government, I think we need to rethink our relationship with Saudi Arabia.
By the way, I want to remind people what happened when the Russians assassinated what they thought was a spy there, mm-hmm. a Russian. They did it with chemical weapons.
That's right.
Which is outrageous. So this is the world we're living in. And this is the world where unless you have the enforcement of international norms, rogue regimes, the Saudis, the Russians, or the Chinese will not care. They will act with impunity for their own interests, including, as we know, with the two Michaels, who for almost 700 days have been behind bars. Now there's China sentenced a third Canadian to death. Now, this is a different situation. This is on drug charges. What do you know about this, and what does it tell you, Dick Fadden?
Well, let me back up a little bit by saying that, for one thing, execution is a regular part of the judicial punishment system in China. And even, you know, 10 years ago, they used to execute tens of thousands of people. They do far fewer today. And in fact, it's a state secret how many they do. From what I've been able to gather, I don't think this has anything to do with their disagreement with Canada. They take a very, very dim view of people engaged in drug dealing or drug manufacturing, and they execute their own citizens as well as foreigners if they're caught in the system. I think the last time they executed a Westerner was around 09 or 10 when a British subject was executed. He's not quite executed yet, as I think you probably know, Evan. There are two more levels of appeal. So my guess is at current time, if the Chinese wanted to send us a message about Ms. Meng and the two Michaels, they would not have picked the drug offense in order to do it. So it may well be that this person was engaged in a drug operation. And the Chinese take a very, very dim view of this.
Yeah, absolutely. They take a dim view. And that's why I say I don't want to equate this case, mm-hmm. to the two Michaels, who really there's no plausible explanation as to why they have been incarcerated and essentially, I'm not going to say tortured, but certainly their conditions would fall under the rubric of torture, according to the United Nations, given the fact that they have no legal counsel 24 hours a day, lights on, very little outside contact. It's brutal what's happened to them. But this other Canadian... Apparently they had like almost 266 pounds of drugs, ketamine. So this is a different story. But I wonder, how do we regard this politically then?
Well, I mean, if these facts are all substantiated, I think Canada should do what it always does. It should petition the government of China not to have them executed. We in this country don't believe in execution, and we've done this, you know, across the world where there is still execution, and hope that the Chinese treat this in isolation and don't link it, you know, to the problems they're having with Canada, but rather take a request from Canada to give the ban a reprieve and go from there. Having said this, you know, inevitably, every time the Chinese do something like this, whether it's linked or not, it's going to be one bit more of additional weight on the difficult pendulum of our relations with China. It's not going to help. I think it behooves us, again, if the facts are all correct, it behooves us to not link the two unless there's real proof that they are linked, and continue to try and do something for the two Michaels and to, you know, I think on our side, if we could do anything to accelerate the case involving Ms. Meng, that wouldn't go amiss either.
Well, look, there's other issues, folks, and I just want to mention them really quickly as I speak to Dick Fadden. One, this sale of TikTok. Donald Trump wants the Chinese-developed TikTok social media service to be sold, and then the question, the Chinese might put pressure on Canada not to participate in, or, you know, in that at all.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Globe reports today that CSIS is saying that there's a program called its Thousand Talents Plan to obtain scientists to give information to the Chinese. So, like, the Chinese are coloring way outside the lines here, Dick, and I know I got 10 seconds for you.
What we've got to do, though, is acknowledge that we cannot do a great deal with respect to China alone, but we've got to start by recognizing them for what they are. They are not our friends. They are our adversaries, and then we need to work with a whole raft of other countries to try and bring pressure on China to put them back within the box where they should be, like every other country on the planet.
Dick Fadden, former head of CSIS, great to have you on the program, sir. What a pleasure.
Cheers.
Man, there's lots going on. I'm going to bring Bob Fife on and talk about this assassination crew from Saudi Arabia next. You don't want to miss that.
The Evan Solomon Show is brought to you by TheraBreath Mouthwash and Toothpaste. Find a store near you at TheraBreathCanada.com.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. This story just broke, and it's Bob Fife and Steve Chase of the Globe and Mail, and it's actually, this is going to curl your hair, if it's not already curly. Saudi Crown Prince sent hit squad to Canada, ex-spy chief alleges. A hit squad, an assassination squad to Canada from Saudi Arabia. Remember what they did to Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who was murdered, cut up with a bone saw in Turkey. And we just had Dick Fadden, the former head of CSIS and the former national security advisor to two prime ministers, say the guy who alleges this, the ex-spy chief, he knows him. He said, I trust him. If he said it, I believe it. Let's bring on half of the dynamic duo who broke the story, Bob Fife from the Globe and Mail. Bob, great to have you back on the program. This story is a stunner. I mean, holy crap. Give us the details on this.
Well, what happened is 2 weeks after a Saudi hit squad rather went to Istanbul to the consulate, the Saudi consulate, where they lured Jamal Khashoggi and then strangled him and dismembered his body. And we still don't know where the parts of his body are. The same hit squad came into Canada at Toronto Pearson Airport in October of 2018. They had a very similar forensic kill kit that was used in the Saudi embassy. I don't exactly know the number of them, but it was quite a number of Saudis. They claim they didn't know each other. The the border security people were concerned about this. I suspect, Evan, that the Americans may have alerted them. And they looked in one of the phones and they saw photos of all of these guys together. So they rejected, they turned away every one of the Saudis except one who had a diplomatic passport. Now, their guy they were trying to, allegedly trying to kill, was the number two guy for the former crown prince who was deposed, and he was a chief intelligence officer for them, and he is highly regarded not only by Dick Fadden and by the Americans, who credit him, for example, helping to stop terrorist bombings of synagogues in Chicago. He's highly, highly respected, and he believes that the Crown Prince, MBS, as we call him, is still not going to give up trying to kill him. He thinks once the U.S. border is open, he's afraid that agents of the Saudis in the United States are going to still try to get into Canada to kill him. He is under private protection. He knows everything about the royal family because he was in charge of the most sensitive intelligence. So he knows where their bank accounts are. He knows who their lovers are. He knows their private estates outside of Saudi Arabia. He has access to an awful lot of information. And I can understand why they would want to probably kill him. And they've already kidnapped two of his children. He got most of his children out, but they've kidnapped two of his children. And they won't let him leave Saudi Arabia. And the Crown Prince has been trying to get him back. But, you know, he's not going to go back because, you know, he's going to get chopped up.
So this is the target here, Saad Jabri, 61, been living in Toronto and since 2017, was the former head of intelligence and security for the former crown prince, now the new crown prince that was supposed to usher in a new era of Saudi Arabia. We now know that's a total joke and a delusion. Mm-hmm. This is the hit squad that killed Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist. And now apparently this, quote, tiger squad. So literally weeks after they murder in cold blood and chop up Khashoggi, they got the tiger squad heading to Toronto to do essentially the same thing.
Yeah, and the tiger squad is a personal mercenary group for the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salam. So that's their squad that goes around killing people for him.
And what's our government's reaction, Bob? What's our government's reaction to the fact? I mean, we're selling light armored vehicles to the Saudis. They're sending hit squads to kill people.
You just hit the nail on the head. This happened in October of 2018. Last summer, they resumed the lab cells to them. What's going on here? Why would we be doing this if Saudi Arabia is sending hit squads to kill people? We still have not had an adequate response from the government. In fairness, I don't think they were aware of this lawsuit that was coming down in the United States, challenge in the United States. I know because I was talking to people before we published, and they were not aware, and they were waiting to actually see the document. So in fairness, they might not have known that. But they certainly were aware that Saudi Arabia had sent a hit squad. They certainly knew that because there's no way in the world that they didn't know this since the border security people stopping at Pearson International Airport. You can almost bet, I bet money, that the CIA had alerted CSIS and other law enforcement agencies in Canada and said, look, there's a head squad coming there. You better watch for them.
I mean, Canada, first of all, thank goodness they were stopped, or we would have had the more blood in our soil. But you've got a story that you published that the Chinese trying to recruit Canadian scientists to get patents. You've got the story now of a Saudi hit squad. I mean, it's like some of these countries regard Canada as just like, hey, we'll do whatever the hell we want.
Yes, it certainly does look that way, because apparently all we did was turn a blind eye, and then a year later resumed selling armored vehicles to them, which a lot of people say are being used by the Saudis in a very brutal war in Yemen.
Right, and we should not trust when they say they're not. By the way, remember, I got to point this out, not only the hypocrisy of the Liberal government standing up for rights but selling light armored vehicles to the Saudis given all this, but remember in the midst of this, John Baird, the former foreign affairs minister was telling Canada, you should be kissing up to the Saudis and apologizing to them. Can you imagine what's going on here?
Yeah, you got to get the John. Of course, John Baer is working for the Saudis, but I believe he's got some kind of work for the Saudis. But you should get him on. Ask him what he thinks. I bet you he doesn't come on though.
No, I bet not. I mean, he literally was on television chastising the Canadian government for standing up for human rights against the Saudis. They're sending hit squads here. It's a joke.
And this is a very serious issue. I don't know how the government's going to respond to it. Obviously, I don't think they wanted this story to get out. And now they're going to have to be answering some questions like, when you found out about this, what did you do?
Well, the big question is going to be, how do you still sell a regime weapons when they're sending hit squads here? I mean,
yep.
And when you found out about it, did you not? Now they're going to say, well, the contract is going to cost us and there's jobs around London. I get all that. But there's a point where if you're not walking your own rhetorical walk, you're not, you know, it's all hot air. But this is a big story, folks. Bob Fife, Steve Chase of The Globe. Saudi Arabia sends a hit squad right after Jamal Khashoggi was murdered. Big, big story. Where's the accountability on this? What will our foreign affairs minister and our prime minister say? The prime minister's on vacation. We'll be getting some fallout on this. Bob, great to have you on the program. Always appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye.
Check out that story, folks, in The Globe. It's a hell of a tale. How do we sell light armored vehicles to a regime that's sending assassination squads here? People, what were the... Bob Fife said the word a kill kit. A kill kit. Come on. If we want to stand up for human rights, if we want to punch above our weight, if Canada is back, it means we got to do something. We can't just be supine and wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah, I know you murdered Khashoggi, but, you know... We're still going to sell you weapons. It's a bad actors violating the norms. That does it for us today. Keep listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network. We'll be back tomorrow. Take good care, everyone.